The Grape Nation is brought to you by Wine Access. Here's a great way to discover and drink the best wines expertly curated for you. Go to wineaccess.com/grapenation for more info.
This week on Meat and Three, we head into the second part of our mini-series on global trade, where we talk about all things sweet, from chocolate and sugarcane to the cultural festival that accompanied the growth of the date industry in the U.S.
They're using this romance and fantasy to say, dates are exotic and you should consume them.
I like to think of the food that we eat as archaeological artifacts, in part because the history of humanity is in the stands in your produce market.
It's not like other foods. We have very personal feelings about chocolate.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Maggie Harrison. We'll talk to Maggie about wine in Oregon and Antica Terra. We'll taste some Pinot Noir for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Far from wine country, Maggie Harrison was born in the Midwest, eventually pursuing a career in international relations and conflict resolution. Well, that didn't last long. Maggie made her way out west to follow her interest in wine. She landed a job with quirky and legendary Sinaquinon winemaker Manfred Kronkel as his assistant for 8 years. Along the way, she started her own small label, Lillian, specializing in Syrah, before a group of friends asked her to look at their property in the Aola Amity Hills of Oregon. Maggie fell in love with the property, joined them, and is now the co-owner winemaker at Antica Terra, making sublime Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Maggie Harrison.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks for having me.
We are talking to Maggie remotely via Zencastr. Maggie, where are you right now?
Well, I'm in my house in Portland, Oregon, about half an hour away from the winery.
And that's where you live? You travel back and forth to the winery?
Yeah, I live in Portland and I drive to the winery or the vineyard every day.
Okay, that sounds pretty nice. All right, Maggie, let's give everyone a little insight into who you are. Give me a little background on your journey in life and wine that ultimately got you to Oregon and the winery. Tell me how this all came about.
I mean, Sam, that's a really long story. I'm going to try.
Just give me the timeline.
You know already. I'm not the best at giving concise answers. I can't even believe you invited me to
do
this.
We'll get to the heavy stuff later on. But just, you know, you came from the Mideast to Syracuse. Move me along quickly.
You're so good at it. Okay, so I'm from Chicago, and I went to Syracuse, and I studied, I got a degree in peace and conflict resolution, which I know sounds like a joke, but that really was a degree. And so when I was in university, I had worked with President Carter, and so he offered me a job when I was done with school to join him at the Carter Center in Atlanta, and I said yes. But before I took that job, I had already accepted a fellowship to go do some studying in Scandinavia, to go live in Denmark. So I went to Denmark, and then once I got on the plane and I went to Europe, I decided that there was too much of the rest of the world that I hadn't seen yet. And so it felt very much like everything was going to get really big, really fast. I was going to have a job and a career. I didn't even know what that really meant. I was going to buy a car. I might get a dog. I don't know. And I was never going to see anything. And so I asked my supervisor and President Carter at the Carter Center, if I could take a gap year, if I could go travel somewhere. And they said, sure. And then once I started traveling, I couldn't stop. And so I spent a year in Europe. I went back to Europe and spent a year in Europe. And then I spent a year in South America. And then I spent a year in Africa. And in between each one, I would go back to Chicago, where I'm from, and I would just work in a restaurant because it was the easiest way to stuff my pockets with a bunch of tip money. And then at the end of the year, I would have, you know, $10,000 or $12,000, and I would buy a one-way ticket and a bunch of inoculations and a new tent and get on a plane. And so I did this for a while.
Did you travel much before this time?
Yeah, I mean, I traveled with my family, but I hadn't, you know, traveled like this, backpack on the back by myself, go someplace with a one-way ticket and just travel until I came home again. That's sort of a journey of a year at a time. And, you know, every time I came back from a trip, I had to call the Carter Center and say, okay, I'm back, but I'm not ready to start this job yet. And the more times I did that, the more it became apparent that there was a chance I really might never go. I really might never take that job. And so when that became real, I could no longer avoid that might be the answer. And I thought about, well, if you are not taking that job, what are you going to do? Right? I had a very expensive education, a backpack, and was a waitress. And it was a fairly complex geometry to figure out what I was going to do next. And so, I was sitting in this bar on, there's an island off the coast of Kenya called Lamu. And, it was then, I don't know if it is now, it was a dry island, but there was one sort of black market bar where you could get a beer. I found it. And so I was sitting in this bar and I was sitting next to a stranger and we were talking. And he asked me what I did. And instead of telling him that I was a conflict resolution specialist, I burst into tears and said, I don't know. And so after I complained to him and cried for a half an hour and told him, I can't go back to Chicago and my boyfriend's waiting for me and President Carter and the thing and then this and my education, he finally got so mad at me that he slammed down his beer and he said, oh my God, sister, seriously, you've just told me everything you can't do, don't want to do, impossible to do. And he said, what do you want to do? And it was really, I mean, I know it all sounds like myth building, but really in that moment when I had to think, well, what is it you want to do with your backpack and your waitressing career? The one thing that I'd gotten really interested in while I was working in restaurants was wine. And I really just, I started learning about wine because it was the easiest way to upsell, to make more tips so I could get on a plane faster. But the more I learned, the more I got to drink things, the more everybody knows it's like learning about art or literature or, right. You know, it's a very burgeoning. Complex. Yeah. And so, the more I learned, the more I loved it. And when he asked me that question outright, I said, I think I want to learn how to make wine. And he said, fine. Are there grapes in your country? And I said, yeah. And he said, great, finish your stupid beer and finish your dumb trip through Africa and go home and learn how to make wine. Stop talking. And so I did just that. And without making this story very, very long, I got very, very, very lucky. And even though I had never, ever set foot in a winery, I'd never even been in a tasting room, I got to be the assistant winemaker, as you said, with Elena Manfred-Krenkel at Sinequanon. And they had to teach me everything. I didn't know how to do anything. I didn't know what anything was. And they taught me everything and let me work there. I was their first employee and the only employee for the first bunch of years that I worked there.
Part of the story is amazing on its own.
It's ridiculous. It's absurd.
You know, just because, who he is, what he's done, his wines, and the fact that it was really just him and his wife. And then he brings you in. I mean, that's crazy. So you spent 8 years with him.
Yeah, I spent 8 years and I would have stayed there for 800 years. I was never, ever going to leave. Right. I have a friend who used to cook at Chez Panisse and everyone used to ask her all the time what she was going to do next. And she said, why would I leave? I'm learning something every day. I'm working for my hero. It's amazing. I love it. Why? It's not broken. Why would I ever fix it? And I felt very much the same way about working for Elena Manfred. I did not want to leave. I mean, I had no plans on leaving. I had no designs. I didn't want to make my own wine. And they really talked me into it. They very much sort of baby birded me out of the nest. And it took some convincing because I had still felt like I had so much to learn from them. But ultimately, they said, look, we didn't give you everything that we know. They told me I could work there forever. They would never fire me. I could work there till I was 95. It was a perfect marriage for them. It was great, but that, you know, I had hit a ceiling and I was the assistant winemaker. They were the winemakers. They weren't going anywhere. So there was no place for me to advance to. And I said, I'm perfectly comfortable. I'll be an assistant forever. And they just said, you can't. And they said, look, we didn't give you everything so that you could give it back to us. That's like a weird Mobius strip of selfishness. And, you know, you're smart. We didn't hire you because you're a dummy. You can do this. And neither of those were convincing. And then finally they said, look, you don't want to be 60 years old and wonder what you could have done. And that one got me. So that night I took a bottle of Sinequinon home and my now husband, then boyfriend, and I went out for burgers. And I told him he had to pay perfect attention to that wine because we weren't going to make that wine and we weren't going to make Grenache, which I do now. But that I wanted to make wine that carried that same level of emotionality. I wanted to make wine that could make people cry. Sorry. I know that sounds very uncharitable. And so we did. We got to make the first two vintages of Lillian at the Sinequinon Winery in their little garage in Ventura. And then in 2006, I got offered the opportunity. Well, you know, I got offered the opportunity to come take a look at the Antica Terra property. And then I got suckered in. And so I moved here in 2006 to also make Pinot Noir here.
And you've been there since.
And I've been here since.
So tell me, pretty good story. I'm just very curious. This is sort of the question of the last 6, 8, 10 months. How has life been during the pandemic? I mean, how has it affected you, your family, you know, you and the winery?
Yeah, it's a huge question. And I think if I were a smarter person, I would come prepared to answer it. I think we're all fine. My family is healthy and we're safe. I have a job that I love. My husband has a job that he loves. I've been able to keep my entire team intact at the winery. And so my family and the 11 families that our business supports are good. We're strong. And, you know, it has been There has been an unnameable pain in this year, and it has. We've all been through similar ringers. Some of us much, much, much worse than others. You know, the only person actually close to me who did get COVID is a miracle of nature. My dad is 83, has every pre-existing health condition, is in assisted living. And got COVID and, it's fine. It's amazing. And so there is a lot to say about the pain and the grief and things that broke in the past year. But I can also say that I really needed this year in one particular way. And that is that I needed this pocket of stillness and it wasn't allowed to be still. I needed some space to think and give myself some real space to think of how to be agile and what agility and what the double helix of agility and beauty meant, right? I think that, you know, I've heard from people that they have pivot fatigue, right? That when you had to sort of write down everything you knew about your business in March of last year and then tear it up and start again, there's been this incredible sort of pivoting from one place to the next. I haven't felt that way because we built a business based really on only one thing, which is it's the most beautiful, whatever's the most beautiful answer of what's in front of us, we're going to do that. And so it really acted as North Star, but what it gave us the opportunity to do was really just execute with much greater velocity than we have in the last decade. It sort of fast forwarded whatever our strategy was for where we wanted to get next. We got to do all of those things all at once, just because I wasn't on a plane every other week going to a different market. other Ingrid and Colin weren't on planes every week. We weren't hosting guests at the winery as much as we usually would. And so all of these additive layers of beauty that are usually in front of us, unfortunately got lifted and taken away for a time. But what it gave us was time to be together in a very different way and be really creative about what we wanted to do and how we wanted to act in our community and what deepening of the relationship with our membership really looked like. And there's no way to talk about it that doesn't seem tone deaf. I'm filled with gratitude that I got the space that we were able to pull the business through and to fortify the business and to work with my scrappy little team of magic makers to really actually do the things that we've been talking about for a lot of years. And so somebody's going to come back and complain about this. I feel really energized.
I don't think you're alone. I think, you know, you didn't mention it, but I'm positive that you spent time with your family like you never have, you know, with the kids, with your husband, solving their problems, you know, and all of that. I think people have gone through, you know, gone through this in many different ways. I mean, you know, I think it's very fair, you know, what you said and you know, what you were able to do with the time. So it's
yeah,
not gonna
I
come
think
back
that there were
you.
Fires, both literal and figurative, that we could not put out. And then also there was just some imaginative and creative fuel that got poured on this year. And I feel really grateful I am still in a position to capitalize on that energy and make something out of it, because there is a lot of making to do.
Yeah. I was going to ask you to tell me a little about, you know, I wouldn't let you go without talking about Manfred a little. I don't want to spend a ton of time on it, but, you know, we talked a little about the influence he had on you. I mean, he let you and pushed you go your own way. He's a guy like you that didn't have any formal training. You know, so I'm curious, what did you learn? You know, how did you learn? Did you have to figure stuff out on your own when you left him? I mean, that's a very unique situation, two people making wine that, you know, didn't have that formal training.
Right. It's like the shags.
And your wines and his wines are brilliant. I mean, you know, that's the funny thing. Yeah.
I have one of his wines sitting right in front of me on the table, actually. Look, Elaine and Manfred gave me everything. I tried to be very careful and judicious about not using their name to ever promote my work, because they already gave me everything. They, you know, and I probably wouldn't have made my, I mean, when I walked in the door, I finally got to have an interview, which was the dumbest interview of all time, because I was so nervous that my neck muscles closed around my throat and I couldn't speak for like the first 90 minutes. They took me on this whole tasting through the cellar, and they knew I wasn't a mute because we had spoken on the phone before, but I couldn't speak at all. Not, I couldn't make anything come out across my vocal cords at all. And finally, after honestly a really long time, like 48 minutes of tasting through the cellar, they put this wine in my glass. And I looked at them and I said one word, which was wow. And they just looked at each other like, what is happening? And one of the questions that Manfred asked me in that interview is, he said, you know, what's your end game? What do you want to do? You want to make your own wine one day? And I said, I don't know. I have no idea. I might suck at this. Sorry, am I allowed to say that? I might be terrible at this, right? Like, I have no idea. And
you really had no idea.
No, I'd never been in a wine. I'd never been on that side of it at all. And honestly, had I worked for somebody else, I probably wouldn't have made wine, right? It just happened to be what Elaine and Manfred were incredibly generous with me, and also gave me all of this space and all of this trust right off the bat. And if it was a technical winemaker and there was a way that things were done, right? We do it this way and then we add this to get it to this metric, I probably wouldn't have liked it. I wouldn't have stayed. But the way that Elaine and Manfred make wine and the way they think about living a life and creating beauty and the relationship that they had with their clients and their members was breathtaking to me. And so it was, you know, it was very much like you said, they wouldn't have hired somebody who had gone to school for winemaking or at that time who had worked at another winery. Now, lots of people have worked there and they have different levels of experience. But when I was there, you know, when they were hiring me, which, you know, remember, it was before the internet. I'm really old. It was before the internet. And so it wasn't like there was even a community. There was no way to find somebody to come work for you. What were they going to do? Put an ad in the back of the LA, you know, the LA Times. And so.
The funny thing is it plays well because he doesn't give a crap about the internet anyway.
No, he does not give a crap.
He doesn't care about social media. You know, he could sell his wine through, you know, a mailing list. It's just ironic. He could live in that bubble and succeed.
It's exactly right. And look, I was a terrible student, right? I barely graduated from college. There was much more pitchers of beer and tabs of acid than there was time in school. And so had I worked for someone where there were a bunch of technical things to learn and a lot of conversation about science, I just wouldn't have resonated with me. It's not what I loved about wine, but everything that I loved about wine was reflected back in multitudes by being in a room with Elaine and Manfred. And what they said to me when I got there was, you don't have to know anything. We'll teach you everything, you know, we want you to do. We want you to do it exactly the way that we want you to do it. And we just need you to work hard. And that's the part that I just hadn't recognized was in me until they gave it space, right? So I thought that they gave me that part of myself, this part that, you know, this perfectionist, this maniacal rigor, you choose the one thing and then you do it no matter what it takes. Except, you know, on the other side of working there and now, you know, at being this age, I look back at things that I did before I knew them. And I was incredibly rigorous about my work, but there's just not a lot of, you know, I didn't make a lot of room for that in any environment, in a restaurant or in college, or in my work in conflict resolution. And they just, they gave that fire a lot of oxygen. And so it felt amazing to work there. And the only rule, right, you know, that people would come all the time. Well, all the time. We didn't let very many people visit because we were working, but once in a while, somebody would come visit and they would ask all these questions about, you know, oh, where did you get that drawer that you keep your bungs in? And what shoes does Manfred wear? And all these things. And the reality is that Manfred was so incredible. Both Elaine and Manfred were incredibly open and incredibly generous with the way they thought about winemaking, how they made decisions, how they felt, how they farmed. But everyone was always looking for the secret. What was the one thing that they could learn when they walk in? And the one thing that they could have taken away, nobody ever paid attention to, which was that the work matters, right? It's all in the details. And if you're going to take your eye off the details and cut a corner here, or cut a corner there, or compromise here, and people think they don't. People think that they are not compromising. It's all in the name of handcraftedness. But the real secret that they
taught me is that's the maniacal rigor.
Yeah, it's all in the work. It's craftsmanship matters and values matter. And if you can marry those things and you stay true, right? For me, it is that we have to make the most beautiful choice for them.
So take that forward with me, because I would say that you have an unconventional philosophy to farming and winemaking. I mean, you pick and you ferment fruit differently. You're famous for blending blind, or you blend by blind tasting. And you know, even though wine is an annual thing, a lot of wines and wineries try to make the same thing every year. You know, the possibilities change every year, and you recognize that. So talk a little about, you know, your philosophies in farming and the things that you do that you know are different, and that really make the wine, you know, unique and terrific.
I mean, that's very nice of you. I think you're the first person that's ever called me famous. And thank you for calling anything I do terrific.
Hey, you're famous to me.
Excellent. Me and you, Sam. I honestly, I'm not smart enough to do it another way, right? I can't hold a synthesis of enough information in my body to be able to make decisions about whatever, farming.
Is that the science you're referring to?
Just even science or even what happened before. I mean, sometimes I'm with other winemakers and they can say, ah, we saw something like this in 1994. And what I did then is I just added more sulfur in my pre-fermentation. You know, I honestly, when I sit down to write my release letters and I have to talk about a vintage that happened 2 years ago, you know, the things that I remember have nothing to do with that. I don't carry that sort of information. I mean, honestly, I'm like a magpie. I'm the world's greatest dilettante. I know a little tiny, shiny thing about everything. And so it's, you know, maybe if I had a lot of tools, right? And I knew all of this stuff and I had been to school and I understood, you know, why grape skins thickened and then what it did. I'm like, maybe I would make different decisions. It's just not the way I'm built. And so all I have to carry into it is what sounds good. it's not so different from going to a restaurant and looking at a menu. I went like, what sounds good? What's going to feel best right now?
And what's in front of you?
Yeah. And so, you know, the way that ends up being different, and if we, you know, and I'm not entirely sure that it is that, you know, instead of saying we're going to take this block down to 2 tons the acre, you know, what Elena Manfred taught me is, you know, for example, with pruning, is that there needs to be enough space between each cluster for a hummingbird to fly through, right? And so on some vines, that means I'm going to drop 3 clusters, and on some, it means I might drop 13. That's not a calculation other than standing and looking at the thing in front, in this case a vine, standing and looking at the one thing in front of you and saying, what looks good. And then you do that thing for that thing in front of you, and then you move to the next, and you just trust that if you're always staying with what looks good, then you can't end up in a bad place. And you might not know where you're headed, but it's, if you just connect, right, you just string together this good feeling and this good work with the next and the next and the next, that you're going to end up with, you know, the best feeling version of what was possible in those fields and you're building in your hands in that year. And so that is, you know, that's how the blending blind came about. I mean, for a couple of big reasons. One,
explain, I what does it mean? I mean, just, you know, yeah, walk and me so, through it.
Yeah. The way that I learned how to make wine, and I won't make this a long story, the way I learned how to make wine, it breeds a huge amount of diversity in the cellar. And I can say that because diversity is not qualitative, right? Diversity is qualitative when we're talking about nature, right? Biodiversity is incredibly important. Diversity in a cellar is not qualitative. If you have 20 barrels and they all have the exact same wine in them, they're the exact same barrel, and the wine is superlative, you just won. It doesn't matter. Good is good is good. It's just that the way that Elena Manfred taught me how to make wine, when you don't have sort of an overarching idea of where you're headed or where you want to go, or you're trying to get your wines to do what you want them to do, right? If you're just meeting the wines where they are and then following them to what looks like the best solution, you end up with this sort of tessellation pattern across your cellar. Things become very different from one another in a very fractalized sort of way. And so, you know, if you and I were in the cellar together today, I could do what everyone does, and we could dip a thief into different barrels, and I could show you, you know, here's Seven Springs Vineyard versus Hopewell Vineyard, here's Hopewell versus Cherry Grove. Or I could just take you through, you know, the 15 different blocks in at the Antica Terra Vineyard. But I could also just take you through, you know, the 17 barrels that came from a single block picked on a single day. And each barrel is really wildly different from the one next to it. All 17 are different from one another. It's very much like, you know, a cellar full of fraternal twins. Everything is related by DNA and then completely different, right? Unrecognizable as siblings. And so I think you are left conventionally with sort of two choices when you go to put your wines into bottle. You can say, okay, now I'm going to look at all of this diversity and I'm going to take my very favorite barrels, right? And I'm going to take those and I'm going to put them together and I'm going to call that my reserve bottling. I'm going to charge a lot of money. And then I'm going to take my next favorite barrels. And there's probably going to be more of them even. I'm going to take all those and I'm going to put them together and I'm going to call it my flagship bottling. And then I'm going to take everything that's left over and I'm going to put it in something together and call it my entry level bottling, or, you know, I'm going to use it for buy the glass. And ultimately I just don't, you know, I don't understand that concept really, only because I only want to make a reserve level thing. I don't like, if somebody in the winery, if I ask them to make a report for me, I've never done that, but say I did, I say, go make a report. And somebody brought it back and said, hey, here's my flagship report. I can make a better one, but I'm not going to give that to you. Here's my medium grade for it. Like, I don't know why we would let winemakers talk to us in that way or allow for that sort of optionality. And so that didn't really feel good. And then the other way is to say, okay, I work with 10 vineyards, and so we're going to make 10 bottles of wine. And look, that is a very sacred process, right? I understand that each place speaks with its own voice. It is absolutely true. In our cellar, right, all of those places are kept separate with intense granularity, right? Every this side of the vine and that, and the top of the hill and the bottom and this, everything is separate. And yet, I wouldn't just put them together in a bottle just as an intellectual exercise. The separation is only of interest if it creates the thing of, I shouldn't keep using this word, the thing that's most delicious, most clear, most whole, right? That tells the clearest story. And so instead we blend all the wines blind. And by that, right, what we do is we take a sample from every single barrel of, I don't know, in this example, Pinot Noir in the cellar. And we put them in numbered sample bottles and we put them all down a table, or more likely in boxes next to the table. And then we just move through them. And so on the first day, there are three of us at the table, one of whom you're going to talk to later this month. We just move through and we taste each one and write notes on each barrel just by the numbers. And then over the next 9 days, we do it in 3 day blocks for about 8 to 10 hours a day. We just put things together and take them apart and put them together and take them apart and put it in every different way we can think of until we find the place where the wines feel lovely, where we can't make them any better anymore. And so the thing is, Sam, right? It's only at the end of this whole process that we have the reveal, right? Like where we lift the curtain and see what was in those barrels. So, you know, I could be looking, I'll have a, you know, a laptop screen in front of me or a piece of paper in front of me, and it'll say Botanica. And then under Botanical, just have a long list of numbers that refer to all these bottles, number 6, number 17, number 132, number 45. And then, you know, oftentimes next to those numbers, there will be a second number, which is what percentage or how many liters from that barrel we're using. And it's only when we're done that we then look and see, okay, what's Botanica made of? And that's when we can match up what was in those numbered bottles to where that wine came from. So that's the moment that I find out what the alcohol percentage is, what the new oak contribution was, what the whole cluster inclusion was, and what the cépage is, right? So there's always the possibility, and in fact, it happens, that I can look and say, oh my gosh, look at that. Botanica is 100% from the Hopewell Vineyard. Great. And I am deeply devoted to Hopewell Vineyard. And yet I'm still not going to make a bottle that says Hopewell on it just for the sake of carrying its name. If it's going to rise into a bottle by itself, it has to be because it proved out through blind tasting that it was the most beautiful thing that was possible. And I think, wait, can I keep talking about this for a minute? I mean, I think One of the reasons I wish, not because I wish there were fewer vineyard designated wines in the world or fewer flagship wines in the world, but the only reason I wish more people did make their selections in this way is because we're a really young community. I mean, I am not young, but we're only in our first or second generation of winemakers in this country. And so I feel like we're squandering the opportunity to just see where the value is, right? See the things that actually deserve to stand alone. What aspect, what orientation, what plant material. And I think we have this intense pressure as a younger wine growing region to sort of ape an archetypal ideal. We have to make what we do here look like Burgundy, not just in winemaking or the way we talk about the wines, but also a smaller place has more value than the bigger place. That place has more value than the even bigger place. And so we draw these lines around things and decide that this sense of place and specificity is the most important thing, has the highest value. And yet when I look at places like Burgundy, right? I mean, it took 180, 300, 500 years in some of these places to draw those lines. And oftentimes those lines were drawn for political reasons. It's not necessarily because, you know, those wines were better than that. And I think by not doing the work, by not taking the time, by not just allowing ourselves the vulnerability of seeing, and just being allowed to see that we squander the opportunity to give to whoever comes next, to like give to the next generation, a clearer story, for us to be able to learn more than we were given when we were given the reins.
Right.
Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. We have to take a break. But I had a quick question before we break. And then when we come back, I want to talk to you specifically about some of the wines. Then I want to subject you to our wine list. And then I want to talk about the wine in front of me. So a quick question before we break. So the process that you go through resets and starts all over the following vintage, right? I mean, maybe in your mind, you know, there's notes and remembrances, but, you know, you re-skew everything, right? I mean, it's blind again, and the Botanica may not be any Hopewell, right? Potentially.
That's exactly
right. Crazy.
I mean, kind of. And then I can't really figure out how people do it any other way. Well, our blending sessions are kind of grueling. I mean, just putting that many wines, you know, into it, your body over the course of a day is hard. But if I had to try to figure out, I mean, look, we have this huge amount of vintage variation in Oregon, and okay, less so in, you know, 15, 16, 17, but every other vintage, right? For the warmest, the coldest, the wettest, the driest, the latest, the earliest, it's a really big span between those two poles. And if I had to make a 2012 try to taste like an 11, if I had to take a 13 and make it, or a 14 and make it taste like a 13, those the things that you have to do as a winemaker are quite brutalistic. I mean, that is a brutal process to try to take. It's like taking somebody who was born left-handed and trying to make them right with their
right
hand.
I mean, I like the way you do it. It's a very natural thing. All right, Maggie, we're going to take a quick break. We're talking to Maggie Harrison. Maggie Harrison is the winemaker and one of the owners at Antica Terra in the Ole Amity Hills in Dundee, Oregon. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Grape Nation. I want to talk to you about wine access. You know, I like to enlighten, inspire, and motivate you to try and drink more wine. Whether you're new to wine or a pro, Wine Access makes it easy for everyone to learn about and buy wines. Wine Access will help you choose the right bottle, whether you're looking to spend a few bucks or splurge on that special wine. Let the Somms, Master Somms, and Masters of Wine at Wine Access sort through everything. It's all about the curation. These guys taste over 20,000 wines per year, and they only select the finest wines, exceeding expectations and over-delivering on price. They equip you with the knowledge and stories behind each bottle, taking the guesswork out of choosing that great bottle. Discover your new favorite bottles with Wine Access and ask about their wine club too. They have an exclusive offer available just for the Grape Nation listeners. 20% off your first order. That's even better than a case discount at most places. Just go to the special URL, wineaccess.com/grapenation, and the discount will be applied at checkout. That's wineaccess.com/grapenation. We're back with my guest, Maggie Harrison. Maggie, the winemaker and co-owner at Antica Terra. Let's talk a little about your wines. I think one of the prevailing themes about your wines and the labels really has to do a lot with the area and the soils, you know, that these vines and plants grow in. Your little part of the world is kind of a unique place. I mean, explain that a little.
I am.
That's going to be hard for you.
I am probably the worst person to speak about the Willamette Valley at large as. Except
I didn't ask you that. I asked you, you know.
Oh, just my vineyard?
You have this.
I thought I was giving geology class.
No. I was going to ask you that, and then I realized not to.
That I'm a person who holds no information in my head? Yeah.
I didn't mean that, but you have a unique, you know, plot. you know, with small berries, and they really have to, you know, dig in. You know,
I got that.
Yeah, quickly though.
I will though say that the Willamette Valley is the greatest place to make wine. It is the most incredible community. Even though I am their worst spokesperson, I will say that the community of winemakers here is the best. This little vineyard, the one that tricked me into moving to Oregon altogether, it's true. It's a little bit of a geological anomaly. And ultimately, right, if I was more articulate in speaking about the geology of this place as a whole, you know, all of Oregon was 40 million years ago under the Pacific Ocean. And then it rose in these sort of diagonal lines. So wherever you're standing in the state of Oregon, no matter where you are, if you dig deeply enough, you will get down to this parent rock. And that parent rock is this very, very, very compressed marine material from you know, it is prehistoric ocean floor. And if you break open that rock, it is all sown with bright white marine fossils, all, you know, clams and oysters that are 40 million years old. It's very beautiful. And so at the Antica Terra vineyard, you know, just the way that it was formed geologically, if you look at the Willamette Valley, you know, the Eola Amity Hills typically has the shallower soils than some of the other sub-AVAs. But even then, you typically have to dig about, you know, 35 to 90 inches to get down to this parent rock. And parent rock, again, is not qualitative. It's not better than having deep joy soils or any other soil. It's just down there somewhere. But the way Antica Terra was formed geologically, there's just no younger geological material. So the vines were planted, you know, there's 0 to 16 inches of any soil on top of this solid sheet of rock. And what's different there is, you know, we've all, or many of us have been to rocky vineyards. If you go to the, you know, the rocks district of Milton Freewater or Chateauneuf or things, it's cobbles, right? You walk and there's no soil at all. It's just these fist-sized rocks all next to each other. And what you have there is this incredible space for roots to descend into the earth, right? I mean, there are, you know, when you put two rocks together, there are gaps between them and plants can grow down into them. This is much more like trying to plant a vine on top of a concrete floor, right? It's just this solid sheet of parent rock. And so, yeah, as such, they had to work really hard, and there just wasn't a lot of energy. And so it's not that the vines still sit on top of this cement floor, right? They found cracks and fissures and places where they could get through and reach water and things, but they're just stunted, right? It gave rise to vines that are much, much smaller than a typical Pinot Noir vine. And it's very much like a bonsai, right? You can make a bonsai grapevine and it will make teeny tiny little clusters. And the reason a bonsai doesn't grow larger is because you've restricted the space for the roots. And so since there is no room underground for the roots to expand, so it doesn't allow the vine to expand above ground. And so everything about the vines is diminutive, right? The leaves are about half the size of normal Pinot Noir leaves. The vines are about a half to a third the size of Pinot Noir. I mean, the clusters are a half to a third. The berries are tiny. In about a third of the berries, they don't even produce a seed. It's called parthenocarpy. And it's because the vine has been under so much stress for the whole of its life that it's not even positive. It has enough energy to ripen. And its whole job is to reproduce. And so it spares the energy of making a seed just so it can get all of the fruit ripe enough to be attractive.
Does it create more intensity?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And then on top of that, so we have these tiny clusters, these tiny berries, right? And then we are on the western side of the Eola Amity Hills. And so it is called Eola, right, from the wind, because it's a very windy place. There is this marine inversion and the wind comes in from the sea across the Van Duzer corridor, right? But, you know, most of the vineyards in the Eola Amity Hills are on the eastern side. So there's a buffering effect as the wind sort of comes to the hills and then curls around the other side. We're on the western side. And so it's very much like if you're standing outside in the cold and in the wind, you put on a heavier jacket. And our grapes do the exact same thing, right? Because they are in this colder place and they're being buffeted by the wind at night, they grow incredibly thick skins. And so the result wine from the Antica Terra vineyard is really unlike anything else we work with. And again, I'm not saying it's better than anything else. It just, you know, it has this architecture and these sort of Barolo-like tannins and this intensity. I mean, this sort of non-fruit chisel and cut and this sort of monstrous kind of intensity I might want, right? If I was a different kind of winemaker and I said, I make wines that are pale, fair, and ethereal, and lithe, and lifted. Those things sound beautiful to me. That is not what Pinot Noir from that vineyard is ever going to do, right? It is a very
That's interesting.
Muscular, architectural sort of expression of Pinot Noir.
So you make a handful of Pinots, you make a Rosé, you make Chardonnay, you make stuff every year and then you do some bottlings, you know, when it sounds right. Based on our discussion about the blending, you know, how do you determine what is an Antica Terra or a Ceres or a Botanica? I'm just curious now with your, you know, blending process, how does that come about?
Yeah, it's a great question. And so the first thing we do at the blending table first is we taste a composite of all of the Pinot Noir altogether, just to try to understand the character of that vintage overall and really just to get a sense of how much is in there that we hate, right? Like just, how good is it already? And the answer is, you know, usually you can just feel like, oh, there are some rotten apples in there that we gotta find and drop out. But then the very next thing we do is we just take all of the barrels that came from the Antica Terra vineyard and put them on the table by themselves. So, you know, I might have 24, 28, 30 different 30 different picking lots from Antica Terra, and then they divide into all these different barrels. So we put those on the table. And so on the first day of blending, I know what's in front of me is only from my own vineyard. And we work there to see if any or any part of any of the barrels comes together in a way that is whole and complete and clear on its own. And if they do, then I bottle something called Antikythera. If they don't, if there's nothing there that I think is great. Then we won't make a wine. And so so that's Antikythera. And then once we found that, we take those bottles off the table.
Would you say that's your estate? That's sort of the estate vineyard?
Yeah, that is the only vineyard that I own. That's the only vineyard that we own. And then once we find that wine, then we take all of the other bottles from the whole rest of the cellar, put them back on the table, and then start at it again. And so Ceres and Botanica, all they are, you know, when we have all of these bottles on the table, you can see there's this atlas of expression. There's this huge range. And we know this from drinking Pinot Noir anywhere, right? It goes from pale, fair, ethereal, you know, all the way through to sort of stacked and grippy and sappy, and 16 different versions in between. And they're all lovely. And so we can see on the table in front of us this whole, you know, expanse of expression. And to make Ceres and Botanica, all we're doing is turning our attention towards the two ends of the range of the spectrum, right? Wherever, whatever we see in that year, if it goes from light to dark or from blue to red or, you know, mineral and delicate to you know, sappy and dripping, I make one mineral and delicate and one sappy and dripping. And we sort of find the natural point of bifurcation in this atlas of expression that's in front of us, and unzip it and make two wines facing towards the two poles.
Right. So the Ceres is the minerality based one, and the Botanica is a little sappy and sanguine.
Yeah, right? That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Now, two more questions, then I want to subject you to our wine list.
I'm scared.
The shards that you make, Oregon is a good place to make shards, let's say, versus a Napa. Why? I mean, stylistically, it plays to what you like.
I would make Chardonnay in Napa too.
With the climates and all that, can you make the same?
No, it wouldn't be the same, but I think you can make something beautiful. I love making Chardonnay altogether. I love making white wine, and I love making Chardonnay in Oregon. And the reason I love making Chardonnay in Oregon is because typically the weather doesn't, you know, it doesn't force our hand. Meaning there is this, I won't be long about this, I swear, but you know, when we say things like, oh, it's so much nicer to make wine in, you know, Chardonnay in Oregon than it is, say, in Napa, it's because in Napa there, you know, where the sun shines reliably, things can get very rich very quickly. And so so if richness is something that you don't like, it's very hard to avoid richness. What is exciting for me in Oregon is that I am not afraid of richness. I mean, if I look at some of my, you know, the greatest Chardonnays I've drunk in the world, they're not small or shy or hesitant wines, even when we talk about the greatest wines from Burgundy, right? Ravenna is not a pinched or thin wine, nor is Cosh, right? These are massive, powerful wines. And so what I love about making Chardonnay in Oregon is that we can really lean into that without the risk that things are going to fall over the edge, that they're going to get too oily, too blousy, too flat, too dull, because it is just simply colder here. And so we get this much longer season. The season is shorter, but we are allowed to let the fruit hang out there longer and really develop flavor in a different way. And I find that really exciting.
Yeah. I'm anxious to try the Chard. One thing we didn't talk about, and I just want you to address it, is vineyard practices, sustainability, organics. What are you doing? Where are you with that?
Yeah, I mean, when we bought the Antikythera vineyard, it was being farmed with napalm. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, look, I'd only been in so many vineyards in my life, and they were all farmed pretty beautifully, right? Because we were sourcing them from my old boss and mentor. And so when I came to Antikythera, there were just these bright, like white tan stripes up the hill. And I looked at this guy who was working on the vineyard, and I said, "What is that?" And he looked at me like I was an idiot. I'm like, I hadn't seen a vineyard where Roundup use looked like that. And so that was really prevalent when I got to Oregon. And so we took it to organic in a day. And that's a pretty tricky thing to do because, you know, right, the ecosystem simply doesn't have any natural resilience then. It's sort of like being on chemotherapy for your whole life, and then all of a sudden you get taken off. And so we've been organic, you know, we have only operated in an organic way since day one. I really shy away from any naming conventions, right? I think biodynamics is an incredibly beautiful system, but it's only beautiful in the relationship between the human being and the piece of land. And so if you're only, right, if you're, it's very much like the difference between religion and spirituality, and we're not supposed to talk about that. But, right, like, if you're just going to look at a calendar and you say, oh, the moon is full, I got to do this, and oh, it's this day, I got to go do that, it creates a level of remove.
It's between very intense. Your, yep.
It lacks intimacy. And so some things that we do come from biodynamics, some things come from permaculture, some things we learn from Bill Mollison, some things from Mimi Castile, some things we learn from Jessica Cordett, where it's only, you know, my biggest and most important job is to create a culture in this business that means something, and also to just take care of this piece of land beautifully. And so we do all of those things, and yet I could never put a single name on it.
Well, you don't have to. And, you know, if you back up and talk about how you approach making wine and blending, I mean, this falls in. I mean, you know what you want to do. You have a respect, you know, for the land, and you don't have to put a name on it. All right. We have about... You have to discipline yourself now. We have about 8 minutes left. 8 minutes left. I want to do the wine list, and then I want to taste the wine quickly. The wine list, I'm going to ask you 5 questions. I ask all my guests the same 5 questions. I post these on our social media. Everyone's interested in, you know, your wine preferences. So the first question is, what are you drinking now? Besides your own wine, well, I don't think you drink your own wines much, but what are you drinking? What's in the fridge with the seasons changing? What are you enjoying now?
I thought you meant what was actually in my cup right now, and I knew the answer. I was like,
well, no, that's you know, that's part of the answer, but give me that and go beyond that.
Well, in my cup right now is the same oolong that I drink every single day. Cups and cups and cups of it. It's called Lishan Winter Sprout, and I find it very enlivening. It's very brothy.
All right, so
chlorophyllic.
I'm gonna text you offline because I'm tea obsessed. I'm into pu'er and raw pu'er and greens and all that. So I want to talk to you about that. All right, so tea.
And then what
oolong
is in my
tea.
Refrigerator right now is that I think
wine wise.
Spirit, yeah, what is whatever. In my refrigerator right now that I just opened last night, I know this is going to seem like I knew this question was coming, but I didn't, is actually a bottle of Valentini Cerasuolo. I was rooting around and I couldn't find anything that I actually wanted to drink exactly last night. And so I opened a bottle of 14 Valentini Cerasuolo.
That's a killer wine. And do you and I both agree we love champagne all the time?
I love champagne all the time.
All right, so you did a good job on the first question. Second question is the goofiest, but I'm curious to hear it. Do you have a favorite wine and food pairing? Is there something, you know, obviously you don't eat it every night, every month, but something
I have
that,
to say,
you know, go ahead. I know you love to cook.
So we work with the most incredible chef at the winery, and I know, be really brief, but, and so when people come, he cooks and we serve our wine, and he had a pairing, which was our rosé, the Angelical, with these mussels. I can't believe I'm about to say this word. These mussels in escabeche. It was all of these, right? Aleppo.
The mussels in an escabeche type
Yeah,
sauce,
and so it's just every chili. It's not spicy, but it is intensely chilied. So Aleppo and Sintesi pepper and pimenta splet and these Hungarian chili. It was the most profoundly moving pairing of two things I think I've ever had.
All right, so you should be happy to know that nobody's ever given that wine and food pairing before. Good for you. All right, this one, see if you can answer it. Not hard, but, you know, sometimes people struggle. Favorite wine restaurant and or bar? Is there something locally? Is there something in your travels where you walk in, the selection, the people, it's cool, it's comfortable? Does that ring a bell?
There are so many. You know what? This is going to sound so... I know I'm supposed to say like some hole-in-the-wall divey thing. You know what feels really amazing? A few years ago, a friend and I got to actually go cook at Maison de Colombier, which is in Beaune. We had been working, selling our wine, and we got to go to Burgundy to visit a few heroes. And we met Francois and Roland, who own Maison de Colombier. And I will say that sitting on one of those little couches and drinking off that list and being with them in that space is probably my wine drinking cup of the world.
That is a very good answer, and that is a good prototype to how you answer that question. So we'll leave it at that. All right, fourth question, second to last. Favorite all-time wine? Now, let me back up. When I structured this question, the question was sort of like, hey, Maggie, what was the most expensive rare wine you ever drank? Cool. I'd love to hear that one day. The question really morphed into what was that wine that was important to you, maybe life-changing, influential? What's the wine that's important to you, you know, and a favorite?
Well, it's a tricky one. I will say that the wine that I think about the most lately and that has possessed me for a few years is actually the Sancerre of Edmond Baton.
And wait, so this Sancerre is Sancerre from where?
Vatan. Baton. Okay. And not because I make Sauvignon Blanc or not, it wasn't something that I drank early when I was a waitress. I think I'm supposed to say server. When I worked in a restaurant, it was the thing that cracked everything open. It wasn't that. It's a wine that really stumps me. I don't understand how you make something that feels like that.
That's good. I mean, there's a uniqueness and something that captivated you that has intrigued you.
I'm possessed by it. I keep going back to that wine from any vintage because it feels unlike anything else made from that variety.
That's a great answer. All right, here's the last question. This may be a little hard, but help me with it. Your wines are found in Michelin-starred restaurants. Basically, you could push it all out through a mailing list. They are incredible wines and they're very fairly priced. But when you want to recommend or drink wines, like my kids are in their 20s, for $15-$20, because they don't want to buy crappy supermarket wine and they can't afford what do you think are good value wines? What's a good red value wine? What's a good white? And here's a tip off, like Muscadet is a terrific wine for cheap.
I think what's so exciting these days is that we used to have to say, okay, Muscadet or Beaujolais, right? Like there are these great
neither
things.
Neither are that cheap really anymore. Reliable.
And yet I think that, you know, more recently there is an explosion of people doing incredible work all over the globe with varieties that you can't go out and say, you know what you should be looking for is Trexadora, right? But yet there are producers in all different places who are making things that are outside of the Muscadet and Beaujolais that, you know, sort of reliable houses that we know we can go to that are incredibly affordable and really, really exciting. And so
I agree. Anything specific or you don't have to get into it?
Like, can you see me trying to scan price tags?
I think the idea is that now more than ever, there are great winemakers making some great wines, you know, at some terrific prices.
That's what I meant to say, Sam.
And I think I always tell people, you go into a winery, talk to winemakers. You go into a restaurant, talk to the sommeliers. You go to retailers, talk to them, tell them what you want to spend, and they go out of their way to find these guys, and that's how you come across them. All right, Maggie, we got to wrap up, but you went through the pain to send me wine. I have in front of me a 2014, which is a treat. I think I mispronounced it.
Nobody knows how to pronounce it. I didn't know how to pronounce it.
Antikythera, that was it. So I have the 2014 Antikythera, which is your estate vineyard. Tell me a little about this wine and this vintage.
Yeah, I mean, 2014 was kind of a cakewalk. I think, you know, it is always my nature when somebody asks me to send wine to send
an 11 or 13. Cakewalk as far as the year?
Yeah, it was nothing forced our hand. It was this incredibly long season where there was this, you know, it was cool through the growing season, but then there was this incredible Indian summer. So we let things hang. And, you know, it's one of those vintages where if you didn't make a good wine, I think you weren't paying attention. And yet it's one of those vintages where I think, you know, Antikythera, sort of that vineyard does its best work because there is... Because the window of ripening was open for so long, and Antikythera is a very weird place to try to call a pick because the fruit doesn't express itself in the same way. We got to pick across this whole range, right? It's just like any other fruit. Just if you were going to pick a strawberry, there's sort of the first moment it starts to taste good, and then it moves towards resolve, and then it becomes sweeter, and then starts to fall out of resolution again. And in 2014, because the season was so long, we just had... the window stayed open for a long time. And so we got to pick across a much broader range of expression just from that single place than in most years. And so what I found in that one, you know, 2014, the most barrels from the Antikythera vineyard found their way into that bottle. And because of it, there are just more parts touching it. I think that wine carries a more symphonic quality than some of the wines we've made from the same site.
So I usually drink along with my guest and, you know, we evaluate it, but I'm going to throw everything out and you tell me if I'm right. The color is, you know, a very deep, kind of a deep red to darker. The nose to me is, when I opened it, the room filled up. It's very perfumed. I pick up, you know, blue fruits as much as red fruits. There is a nice little spiciness to it that, you know, is a nice component, not too strong, not too weak. I think the mouthfeel for a Pinot is very, you know, it's, how do I say it without, I don't,
you won't
it's,
hurt my
it,
feelings.
It's, you know, medium to full to me. It feels beautiful
on
the mouth.
It's massive.
Yeah, I mean, there's a glycerin quality.
Let's be honest, it's massive.
But moving to the palate, I mean, it's juicy. I mean, I get some nice acidity, which I think, you know, would make it go with food. There's the tannins are no issue to me. And there's a floral component, you know, that I love from the nose to the palate. That's what I picked up. Is that a fair evaluation?
How could it not be fair? That's exactly what you felt in your body.
But are those things that you've come across?
I think that's exactly right.
Okay.
It's a really nice way to talk about
it. I hate to ask this question, but what type of foods do we pair with a wine like this?
Oh, I mean, dry aged state, right? Like the most expensive Wagyu you can find and then don't really cook it, right? I mean, I think the thing that we forget about Pinot Noir is how well
right.
it
People
can
don't
do
think
in those
Pinot
ways.
Noir with a big, you know, juicy steak. I totally agree with that. Based on my descriptors in this type of wine, I actually may put this in the fridge and throw a steak on tomorrow. That's the 2014 Pinot Noir from Maggie's estate vineyard called
Antikythera.
Antikythera. All right, Maggie. We've been going over an hour. We got to wrap up the show. Let me do a quick wrap up, and then I want to get some info from you. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. You can follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. On Instagram, we're at SBenRuby. On Twitter, we're at BenRuby. Yes, we know that's confusing, so you can always use the hashtag TheGrapeNation on both. As I mentioned, I will post Maggie's wine list. I will also post a little more info on our weekly wine sip, the 2014, on our social media sites. Maggie, for some reason, I don't think you need a ton of help selling your wines, but I'm not going to make any assumptions. But if people want to find out more about Antikythera, you know, on social media or on the internet, where should we go?
Yeah, you just, and also you can just reach out anytime. I mean, I will give you my email address. So if you're looking for the wine and you can't find it, let us help. You know, I am mh@antikaterra.com. The website is antikaterra.com. We are on Instagram at, and it's just antika_terra, I think.
Terra, yeah.
And we would love to just hit us up anytime, whether we have wine to sell or not. Intimacy matters and connection matters. So we would love to hear from you.
Listen, I have to be honest. You know, I've been a collector for a long time. I've been doing the show for 4 years. I kind of stumbled on your wines 3-4 years ago and didn't do anything about it. And then just said, let me go online and, you know, get on the mailing list. And a few years ago, I got on and I started ordering, you know, some bottles here and there. So I assume that can happen at some point with other people if they're interested. So
we
certainly
move people
do
off the waiting list every year. It's not
if they're dormant.
We are not my old boss and mentor. The list is not that long. We are full, and it is a waiting list. But it's we'll get you in.
I love hearing that, and it's at restaurants. All right, Maggie, I want to thank you from the beginning for agreeing to come on the show and responding so quickly. You're just one of those people that is just so responsive. I love that about you. I want to thank our engineer, Amanda, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben-Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.